This is number 0033, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0033. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, we'll meet Michael Palmer. He's a doctor and medical thriller writer, and his latest book is entitled The Last Surgeon, which deals with post-traumatic stress disorder. Why this topic for a thriller?
Each one of the books deals with a medical ethical issue. So before I start writing anything at all, I sit down and I read the newspapers and I think about what's happening in the world and what I might want to present in the form of a thriller. My goal is to kind of raise the issues without answering them. But in the case of PTSD, it was especially important to me because I've known a number of people with this condition from one cause or another. So I decided I would write a thriller based around the theme of post-traumatic stress disorder in our military.
Stephen Shohead is the author of Hollywood Stories, short entertaining anecdotes about the stars and legends of the movies. He has hundreds of stories, like the one about Walt Disney's daughters.
They really had a blissful life, and they had no idea that their parents were constantly worried about them being kidnapped and allowed no circulation of any pictures of them. And one time when Diane was in school at the age of 6, another little girl came up to her and said, "Diane, you never told me your daddy was the creator of Mickey Mouse." And Diane went home and said, "Daddy, you never told me you were that Walt Disney." And she asked for his autograph.
We'll hear from Steve Walsh, our man in the heart of America, checking the pulse of the nation.
Hey, guess what, everybody? I have a new job and I'm not going to be doing this show anymore. April Fools. Hi, this is Steve Walsh. You know, your guy in the heart of America, checking the pulse of the nation. You're going to want to stick around for my two-minute tirade. It's coming up later on, right here on the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And, of course, we have an idiot of the day and lots and lots and lots of stuff. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0033, is Tim Sargent, television reporter for Global News Montreal, tennis enthusiast, major fan of Richard Nixon, and an all-around nice guy, even with that Richard Nixon part. When he's not pounding the pavement, digging up stories for the news, or looking for an available tennis court, you'll probably find him on a bar stool at Dominion Pub on Metcalfe in downtown Montreal, which is conveniently located across the street from the Global Studios. Thank you very, very much, Tim, for being the guest later on this edition of the Stuff File program. Let's get right to the stuff. We start off with a story from Winnipeg, Manitoba. A Winnipeg boy, a 14-year-old, was trying to stop his 31-year-old drunk mother from driving. Now think about what you would do in this situation. Would you A, call the police, B, hide her car keys, or C, stab her? Well, this is the Stuff File, boys and girls, so what do you think? If you selected the answer C, you would be correct. According to police, the boy did take the mother's car keys at first, but then a fight broke out. She ran from the home carrying the boy's jacket, and he responded by throwing a knife and striking her in the upper body. Crazy, sure, but effective. Mom did not drive drunk. She remains in hospital in stable condition. Police would not identify the teen nor the mom, but the boy has been charged with aggravated assault and is being held at a juvenile detention center. These are the kind of mother-son stories that'll come back years from now and be fond memories, I'm sure. In a dysfunctional family, at least. Moving right along, here's a headline you'll love. Sex change killer to wed lesbian murderess in jail. And that's an accurate headline from a British tabloid. And strangely enough, it's rather true. 61-year-old Douglas Wakefield has won permission to get married in the prison chapel where he's an inmate. Doug was convicted of strangling his uncle, beating him with a hammer, and stabbing him 48 times with a garden fork 36 years ago. Boy, I guess he really wanted him dead, huh? Since then, he has undergone gender reassignment surgery, at taxpayers' expense, we might add, and now goes by the name Ty. Anyway, he, or her, or whatever term you want to use, plans to exchange vows with 45-year-old lesbian Thelma Purchase, who's also in prison for life for suffocating a disabled man that she was caring for to get her hands on the $140,000 he left her in his will. The pair must pay their $500 wedding costs out of money they have saved. A prison spokesperson said prisoners are entitled to apply to the governor to register a civil partnership just like anyone else. Hey, isn't that lovely? We wish them well, I guess. Okay. In Indonesia, a 19-year-old boy had a rather extreme reaction after learning his girlfriend intended to marry another man. He chopped off his own penis and threw it down a well. Doctors say the boy from a village in central Java was lucky to be alive. He arrived at the hospital in critical condition from extreme loss of blood. The director general of the hospital said cutting off a penis can be fatal. And sadly, doctors were unable to reattach the dismembered appendage because villagers could not find it. Not that anyone especially wanted to. Hey, Jim, want to help me go look for that dude's penis down a well? Nah, there are very few things I would go down into a well for, and that's not even close to being on the list. But thanks. Okay, on to the Darwin file, because as you know, the tree of life is often self-pruning. And oh, the irony is so thick on this one, it's almost comical. If you haven't heard of James Schneider, he's actually a very well-known global warming activist. But he's no longer with us, as he and a journalist friend were found frozen to death. Their bodies were discovered about 90 miles from South Pole Station by a pilot who said there were two snowmobiles with cargo sleds, a tent, and a bright orange rope that had been laid out on the ice, forming the words, "Help, cold." According to a friend, Schneider had been planning a trip to the ice sheet to film the devastation brought on by global warming. Remember, kids, even if there has been global warming in Antarctica, the average temperature at the South Pole still remains about 70 degrees below zero Fahrenheit in the spring and summer. You've been warned. Okay, 18-year-old Ladarius LeKendrick Lacey managed to escape from a juvenile detention center while the guard who was watching him fell asleep and was still in leg restraints and a blue jumpsuit when his mother marched him right back to the center. No, this wasn't Mayberry. It was actually Fort Pierce, Florida. When asked why he escaped, Lacey said he simply noticed his guard was sleeping, so he walked down the stairs and out the back door. Wow, that's some high-tech security they've got there. Unfortunately for him, his mistake was running straight home to Mom, who was having none of it and brought him back straight away. Frank Pinella, a spokesperson for the Juvenile Justice Department, said the incident is currently under review and appropriate action will be taken. By the way, kudos to Mom. That's what my mom would have done. Not that I would have ever gone to a juvenile detention center. I tell you, if I ever got myself in trouble as a kid, any punishment that the state would have given me doesn't compare to my own parents back at home. That's the way I was raised. There you go. Anyway, moving right along, in Martinsville, Indiana, two police officers have been suspended after they actually used a taser to subdue a 10-year-old boy. The officers responded to the Tender Teddy's Daycare on reports of a 10-year-old who was out of control. The officers claim they were only trying to prevent the child from hurting other children, staff members, and himself by first slapping him, then using a taser to bring him down. A press release from the mayor's office said, while the department will not condone the unnecessary treatment of any subject, regardless of age, in an apprehension situation, additional comments will not be made pending results of the final investigation. Officials say the two officers whose names weren't released have been suspended with pay and placed on administrative leave pending the outcome of the investigation by the Morgan County Sheriff's Department. Seriously. Two grown, trained male police officers can't take down a 10-year-old without tasers? Really? Unless this 10-year-old is built like Mongo from Blazing Saddles, I think these officers need some permanent desk jobs. That's all I'm saying. And finally, in this section of the stuff file, before we get to our first guest, with me, Peter Anthony Holder, 51-year-old Patricia Edwards walked into a Bank of America branch last week in Sanford, Florida, and handed the teller a note demanding money. She later said, "There was no plan, no nothing, just impulse." And when asked why she committed the crime, Edwards said, "Because it was something I had on my bucket list." I think everyone should have a list of things they want to do before they expire. Edwards did note that she suffers from non-terminal leukemia and bipolar disorder and was not taking her medication at the time. But whatever the cause, she now has a nice room at the Volusia County Jail. But at least she's stepping up and owning up to her own transgressions. She said, "I regret everything I did, and I accept full responsibility for what I did, and I'll accept and suffer the consequences, whatever they may be." That's right. Take ownership of it, Patty. Take ownership of it. Let's get to our first guest, shall we? On the line with us right now, from just outside of Boston, is Michael Palmer, or should I say Dr. Michael Palmer. He is a working physician who is also a renowned medical thriller writer. His latest book, which came out in February, is called The Last Surgeon. Welcome back to the program, Michael. I understand this latest thriller deals with post-traumatic stress disorder, correct?
Yeah, post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. This is my 15th book. I'm working on my 16th now, and each one of the books deals with a medical ethical issue. So before I start writing anything at all, I sit down and I read the newspapers and I think about what's happening in the world and what I might want to present in the form of a thriller. And my goal is to kind of raise the issues without answering them. But in the case of PTSD, it was especially important to me because I've known a number of people with this condition from one cause or another. So I decided I would write a thriller based around the theme of post-traumatic stress disorder in our military. I don't know how many Canadian troops are committed to the Middle East right now. Do you know?
We have quite a few, as a matter of fact, and we're also taking high casualties in that regard too, unfortunately.
Yeah, that I'm sure you know. So I'm sure that you're seeing a large number of post-traumatic stress patients as well. And so the theme of the book is the difficulty that these men and women have in getting benefits from the government for their mental or neurological injuries, whereas somebody who, say, had an arm or a leg blown off in the war, it's very obvious what's the matter with them. But when you're talking about post-traumatic stress and a lack of ability to form relationships and nightmares and loss of sleep and inability to hold a job, that's all stuff that doesn't really show up easily on a physical exam.
You mentioned the fact that this is your 15th book, and you write medical thrillers based on stuff that's in the news and things that you see on a regular basis as a doctor yourself. I'm just curious, did this writing for you start as something that was an outgrowth of your daily profession, either from curiosity or in some cases from frustration in some of the things you see within the medical community?
Actually, both. It didn't start with the frustration. It started as a hobby. And I've tried a number of things in my life as hobbies and sort of enjoyed them, but haven't really been outstanding at them in any way. And then I read the book Coma by Robin Cook.
Right.
I don't know if you've had a chance to read that one, but it came out in the late 70s, and Robin was a classmate of mine in college, and then we also trained together. And I just decided that if Robin could write a book, and we have the same education, maybe I could write a book. And my first book dealt with nurses and mercy killing. And that was the beginning of my career, and that was the first sort of medical ethical theme. And then my second one dealt with a different one. And then eventually I got very upset with the state of managed care in this country. And I became really fairly enamored with the system of health care in Canada. And so I decided to write some books about that. A book called The Society, which was about that. And now we're going to get to see whether this sort of stuff works in this country when everybody can get health care, whether they can afford it or not.
I was just about to ask, since you guys just recently passed a health care bill, your thoughts on that, and does it give you an idea perhaps for a future novel, even though you have touched on this type of thing in the past?
I have some thoughts for my next book, but I'm embroiled in the one that I'm writing right now. As far as the new health care bill goes, I think we're all going to have to sit back and see how it actually plays out, how it works. What I do feel like is I'm very proud, finally, that this country, which is so plentiful in our resources and the strength of the people, can finally have people, whether they have a pre-existing condition or not, get health care. And that's always bothered me. So we'll see how it works as it plays out. My new book, which will be done probably in another 3 months, is a thriller about a political medical thriller about a virus that's released during the president's State of the Union message and infects everybody who's in the State of the Union that night. And the president is forced to quarantine the Capitol. That's the new book. But the old one that you alluded to, The Last Surgeon, has done really well, and people are definitely, it's definitely resonating for people as far as the theme of post-traumatic stress disorder.
Now, you mentioned that you were a classmate of Robin Cook, and he writes books, and you write books, and it seems to be there are a lot of doctors out there who are writing books. Here in Canada, we have a fellow by the name of Dan Calla who's put out 5 medical thrillers, and that's just one example. There are several. What is it with all these doctors writing mystery books?
Dan's an excellent writer. I read Pandemic and thought it was really terrific. First of all, there's a lot of very famous writers that people don't know were doctors.
And Michael Crichton, of course, is another one, who recently passed away, unfortunately.
Somerset Maugham.
Yes.
And Arthur Conan Doyle, who wrote all the Sherlock Holmes. Anton Chekhov was a doctor. And I think, in trying to understand it, I think the reason is that 3 of the main requirements for being a successful author are, 1, a love of people, which most doctors have, despite what the public might think. 2, a love of words, which many doctors have. And then 3, discipline. And there's no way you can make it to medical school without passing through organic chemistry. And anybody who's ever had to do it knows how hard organic chemistry is in terms of the amount of discipline required to study. So I think those are reasons right there why doctors write. Plus, the stress of our work is such that we often need to express ourselves, if nothing else, by writing a journal to understand our feelings about our patients, about life and death and heroism and cowardice and so many of the things that we run into every day.
Is part of the reason too the fact that, let's be honest, based on what you do for a living, part of your job is kind of to be a detective. The body itself is a mystery.
That's a very interesting observation, actually. I do think that plays a role in it. And the other thing that was occurring to me when you were asking the question is that we have a huge advantage as doctors in that we know stuff that people don't know, which is the kind of inner workings of the hospital and the inner workings of a doctor or a group practice and some of the dynamics there. And so just like some of these legal thrillers are able to get inside the courtroom so that readers can really understand what's going on and all the backstabbing that happens in medicine, we can do the same thing. And I think that's behind a lot of the fact that we end up being writers as well, because people want to read what we have to say.
I think one of the things that's different about a lot of the newer or this generation of doctors who write is that in a lot of cases, it's not a second career after a medical profession or instead of a medical profession. A lot of people like yourself, like Dan Calla, are still working doctors.
In addition, right. Partly that's that it's really hard to get paid for either career now, so it's good to have both of them. But I don't know for sure what the answer is. Every autumn in October, Tess Gerritsen, who's a tremendously successful physician thriller writer, she used to write medical suspense, and now she writes police procedural stories, which are she's probably the most successful physician writer in the world today. She and I give a course on Cape Cod for doctors who want to be writers. And the attendance has not dropped down despite the economy slumping. We're still getting between 200 and 230 registrations every year for the course. It's a weekend long. And it's all doctors, dentists, psychologists, you know, that kind of thing. So there's a lot of interest still.
Well, they certainly have a good teacher in you, your latest book, the one that's out right now that came out in February, The Last Surgeon, written by Michael Palmer. People can check out Michael's website, which is michaelpalmerbooks.com. And, Michael, I thank you very, very much for taking the time out of clearly what is a very, very busy schedule to talk to us.
Well, it's always great to be with you. Thanks so much, Peter.
Dr. Michael Palmer, author of The Last Surgeon. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is 0033, and you'll find links to Michael's website, plus links to Amazon.com and Amazon.ca, where you can order the book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
What are they saying about If the Rains Don't Cleanse? New York Times bestselling author David Mixner says, as a writer and advocate for Africa, I could not put down Ben Patrick Johnson's If the Rains Don't Cleanse. Aubrey Hooks, the U.S. ambassador to Ivory Coast, says, fascinating and hard to put down. If the Rains Don't Cleanse is CNN breaking news disguised as historical fiction. If people can't put it down, then why haven't you picked it up? If the Rains Don't Cleanse, the tale of missionaries in 1950s Belgian Congo is loosely based on my own parents' lives. It's available online, including Amazon.com and Amazon.ca. I, Ben Patrick Johnson, want you to read this book. My mother, Abidale Johnson, wants you to read this book. Now remember, this is a woman who survived as a missionary in Congo half a century ago. She is tough. Now do not make me send her your way. If the Rains Don't Cleanse, get it now, or deal with my mother. From the land that brought you maple syrup, poutine, ice hockey, and Pamela Anderson, this is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll meet the author of Hollywood Stories, short entertaining anecdotes about the stars and legends of the movies. We'll also hear from Steve Walsh, our man in the heart of America, checking the pulse of the nation. And of course, we have an idiot of the day. But right now, more stuff right here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. If you're familiar with Contra Costa County, California, then you know that county's most famous landmark is the picturesque Mount Diablo in Mount Diablo State Park. However, a group of Christians led by Arthur Millares has decided that they don't want a peak of such beauty and importance named after the devil. They say even in Spanish it's derogatory, offensive, obscene, blasphemous, and profane. So they want the name changed to Mount Reagan. Mr. Millares says, I just happen to be an ordinary man that worships God. He gave me this task in my prayer time. I said, Lord, they're going to think I'm a loon. Well, he was right. In less than a month, more than 80,000 people have joined a Facebook group called People Against Renaming Mount Diablo to Mount Reagan. The Contra Costa County Board of Supervisors, which will vote on the name change, has been flooded with emails running 9-1 against the idea. Many of the idea's detractors don't see how there could be much of a difference in renaming the mountain after the 40th president. One online poster wrote, I absolutely agree that Reagan was the devil, and any monument that is dedicated to him is an absolute disgrace to anybody's sense of moral fortitude. Per Nancy, just say no. Even Reagan lovers seem to think the idea is whacked. One wrote, I'm a huge fan of Ronald Reagan, but this is just nuts. I wonder how Global's Tim Sargent feels about a mountain named after Ronald Reagan. Anyway, by the way, have you ever noticed that when people talk to the Lord, that's usually called faith, but when the Lord answers, that's called psychotic? Just a point I want to bring up, that's all. Okay, speaking of insane, let's go to Britain, shall we? It appears our British animal-loving friends have gone around the bend. 66-year-old great-grandmother Joan Higgins owns the Major's Pet Shop. She has just been fined $1,500 and ordered to wear an ankle monitor for a 7-week curfew period when she can only leave the house to go to work. What is her horrible crime, you ask? What was so heinous that she was sentenced this way? Her horrible crime? Selling a goldfish. Yes, a goldfish to a 14-year-old boy. You see, there's a 2006 law on the British books that forbids selling live fish to anyone under the age of 16. And apparently, they take this law just too dang seriously. Now, Ms. Higgins' son, 47-year-old Mark Higgins, who participated in the sale, was also ordered to pay $1,300 and given 120 hours of community service. And it turns out that the teen who bought the fish was sent into the store as part of an undercover operation, because Scotland Yard has already solved all of England's other crime problems, including terrorism, so they've got time to pick on great-grandmothers who are selling goldfish. A to go there, Scotland Yard. A to go. Meanwhile, Maria Rita Manzoni is looking at possibly 20 years in prison, all for uttering one word. Of course, that word was terrorist, and unfortunately for her, she yelled it out on a United Airlines flight from San Francisco to Washington, D.C. The flight had to make an emergency landing in Omaha as a result. Apparently, Manzoni used her call button and told the attendant she felt ill. Then on the way to the restroom, she told the flight attendant that the men sitting in her row were terrorists. She said one had a bungee cord and a voice recorder. The other had a GPS device and a cell phone. The flight attendant had Manzoni sit in the rear of the plane, and then the attendant talked to the men. After she did, she didn't believe they posed any threat to the aircraft at all, or to the crew, or to the passengers. Later in the flight, Manzoni reportedly became hysterical, screaming, "Terrorist!" while pointing at flight attendants and pushing her way toward the first-class cabin. Once there, two male passengers and the flight attendants subdued her and applied restraints. Flying the friendly skies of United Airlines. Elsewhere in the stuff file, Daryl Deshaun Jones is 35. He called police to say his car had been stolen. Worse, he allegedly reported his six-year-old cousin was asleep in the back seat. Police in Houston, Texas, put out an Amber Alert for the missing Lincoln Navigator and brought in the FBI. As the hours tick by, officers got more worried until they noticed that Jones was more concerned about his car than he was his cousin Kevin in the back seat. As the day went on, it was becoming quite clear that this was all a hoax, said a detective. Jones falsely claimed a child was involved to get his car back quicker. Jones was arrested on charges of filing a false crime report, a felony punishable by up to 2 years in prison. Yeah, that car is going to depreciate a lot in that amount of time when he's in prison behind bars, but then again, the mileage will be low. Moving right along, an unnamed man in Bonita Springs, Florida, got upset at a clerk in a cell phone store. He says the clerk skipped him to help someone who came in after him. The man admits he threw his coffee at the floor and then stomped out, but the clerk chased after him, telling the man to get back inside the store and clean up his mess. The man instead got into his car, and the clerk stood in the way, saying he was going to call police. The clerk told police the man then ran into him, but the customer says the clerk jumped on the hood of the car. The man panicked and drove off, police say, but he left one thing behind in the store besides the coffee on the floor. He left his wife. That could be the best thing that ever happened to her, by the way. Just pointing that out. Let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. One Hollywood tour guide is exposing the naked truth about celebrities. Stephen Shohat has penned Hollywood Stories, short entertaining anecdotes about the stars and legends of the movies. He's on the line with us right now from Hollywood. Hi, Stephen. How are you?
Hey, Peter. I'm great. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for being on the program with us.
You got it.
So how did you get from tour guide to author? Was this a natural progression for you?
Well, yeah, it was a long one, but it was kind of a natural one because on the tours, I decided to make them as anecdotal as possible, and I collected so many anecdotes, I thought people would like to read about them outside the tour bus, actually. So, it was long. The book took about 10 months to write, but it's about 20 years of research, actually.
So what's the difference between an anecdote, for instance, and out-and-out gossip?
Well, I try to do a vintage thing. Like for example, one of the anecdotes I have in the book is about Walt Disney. I have many anecdotes about him, but he had two daughters. Their names were Sharon and Diane. Unfortunately, Sharon passed on, but Diane's still with us. and their home life was very secluded from the whole Disney world. He allowed no pictures of Mickey Mouse in the house. You know, and he had fun with them. Like sometimes he'd chase them up the stairs and cackle a little bit, like he was for the Wicked Queen in Snow White. And when he was a little bit angry with them, he'd raise his eyebrow with stern admonishment. And that actually inspired the drawing of the owl, or the creation of the owl in the movie Bambi. And they really had a blissful life, and they had no idea that their parents were constantly worried about them being kidnapped and allowed no circulation of any pictures of them. And one time when Diane was in school at the age of 6, another little girl came up to her and said, "Diane, you never told me your daddy was the creator of Mickey Mouse." And Diane went home and said, "Daddy, you never told me you were that Walt Disney." And she asked for his autograph.
Really?
Yeah, and that's the type of thing I think is a little different than just the typical who's sleeping with who. And you know, I try to get stories with beginnings, middle, and ends, and not really to put anybody down, but to do things that were entertaining or inspiring most of the time.
Now, I understand that you found information about Anthony Hopkins and his characterization of Hannibal Lecter.
Right. When Anthony Hopkins, of course, he was in a movie called The Lion in Winter in 1968. And, of course, that was a great movie with Peter O'Toole and Katharine Hepburn. And he really got to be very close friends with Katharine Hepburn. And of course, she was quite a colorful character. She would take off her clothes each day and go swimming in the Irish Sea. And it was absolutely freezing. And he would say, "Katie, how did you do? How can you do something like that?" And she said, "Oh, Tony, it feels so horrible. It just simply feels wonderful afterwards." And she admonished him for drinking too much, because that was 1968, about a year after she lost Spencer Tracy. And of course, he had drank a lot, and it hadn't had good results. So, you know, they had an interesting relationship, and she had a lot of advice for him. And then I think it was 23 years later, it was actually the role of Hannibal Lecter went through a lot of casting changes. At one point there was talk about Gene Hackman, at one point Louis Gossett Jr., but then Anthony Hopkins got the role, and he had time. He had made a movie called The Desperate Hours in San Francisco, and he had time driving across country from San Francisco to Pittsburgh to really think about how he'd like to play that part. And by that time he was off the sauce, and he was stopping in a lot of AA meetings. And then, of course, he sort of played it like a jack-in-a-box, where every time Jodie Foster's character comes into the room or comes into the prison, it's almost like he's waiting for her and sitting in the middle of the room. And it might have been, or standing in the middle of the cell, I should say, and it might have been publicity, but the crew members on that movie said that they didn't feel comfortable until they had him locked up, meaning Anthony Hopkins, in the morning. And then, of course, he was only on screen for about 24 minutes, and he won the Oscar. And later on, he was asked, "How did you get the idea for this character?" And he said it was partially based on Katharine Hepburn, because she had the controlled madness that he was trying to put across on the screen. It was also based on Hal the Computer, by the way, in 2001, A Space Odyssey.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, Katharine Hepburn was still alive at the time this movie came out. Did she ever know this?
I don't know what her reaction was to that, actually. You know, I'm not sure how she did it, but how she responded to that. You know, whether she was flattered or didn't notice, I don't know.
In all the stories you've had a chance to collect over the years, and the ones that are in the book, what was the story that you would say surprised you the most when you first heard about it?
Oh boy, that's a good question, because there are, you know, literally over 1,000 little anecdotes in this book. So, I really had fun with a lot of the stories about people that you don't normally think of in Hollywood. For example, William Parker, the police chief in Los Angeles, beginning in 1950. If people saw the movie Changeling, the LAPD, of course, considered to be very corrupt. William Parker came in and really cleaned up the force. He did things like For example, he made them ride in patrol cars so they wouldn't walk the beat and get tempted in the streets anymore. He worked with the producers of the TV show Dragnet to put the LAPD in a positive light, to let everybody know how hard they worked. And so people started to respect them, and he was the one who coined the phrase the thin blue line, which meant the police were the only people standing between civilization and anarchy. But there were some cases under his watch of police brutality, and he was asked about that by the press, and he said, well, I can only hire humans, and as long as I can only hire humans, we're going to have human problems. And so people respected him, but they thought he was a very cold, logical, and remote man. Well, one of the policemen who served under him was Sergeant Gene Roddenberry, who left the force in 1956, and 10 years later, he created the TV show Star Trek, and he based the character of Mr. Spock on Chief Parker. Cold, logical, remote. That was, again, there's more than one influence for those things. But stuff like that really interested me and fascinated me. And, you know, another angle was Leonard Nimoy actually based the character of Mr. Spock partially on George Burns. So the actor had a different interpretation because he said that George Burns always kept the same expression whenever he was listening to Gracie Allen. Well, I'm going to keep the same expression when I'm listening to Dr. McCoy rambling on, although I won't have the cigar.
Amazing stuff. And you say you have so many stories, and the thing about it is they're all short anecdotes. You have a lot of them in the book. When you were putting the book together, did you ever reach to a point where you say, I can't fit everything in? In other words, is there a book two?
You know what I did? I gave myself a stop date. It was October the 1st. I said whatever's not in the book is not going in by that day because it got to be really whimsical. The way the book is set up, I had a little 1 minute radio show. I still have it actually. It's called Hollywood Stories, and the main stories are the scripts from the radio show. And then afterwards, several of them have extra things tacked on to them, with little extra stories. And actually, both the Anthony Hopkins and the Chief Parker story are extra stories that are tacked on to the original stories that sort of relate. And so some of the people I really would write a lot about, like, for example, Ronald Reagan got a lot of attention, or John Wayne got a lot of attention. Walt Disney got a whole chapter. It was kind of an act of whimsy. What interest? You have to hope other people are interested too. But I think they will be because I've gotten great reaction telling the stories on the tours, for example. Hmm. And there was just simply a lot of fun stuff. Like Ronald Reagan as a young man was very sensitive about his acting, and he was always talking about politics. And finally, he was going on about it so much, one of his friends said, Ronnie, why don't you run for political office? And he was very defensive. He said, you don't like my acting either? but then years later, when he became president, he was much more lighter-hearted about it. Shortly after he became president, he had a meeting with a congressman from the other side of the aisle, Dan Roskinkowski, and Ronald Reagan said, we're going to cut taxes. And you know why? Because back in 1940, I was in the movie Knute Rockne All-American, and I signed a new contract with Warner Brothers, and I suddenly find myself in a 90% tax bracket. 90%. Now, nobody in this country should pay 90%. Now, what do you have to say about that? And Roskinkowski paused, and he said, 90%? My God, Mr. President. I never thought you were that good of an actor.
The book.
And Reagan laughed his head off this time.
So. The book is called Hollywood Stories, Short Entertaining Anecdotes About the Stars and Legends of the Movies. It's written by Stephen Shohet, and you can check out his website, which is hollywoodstories.com. I thank you very, very much, Stephen, for taking the time to be on our program.
Anytime, Peter. Anytime, buddy.
Stephen Shohet, author of Hollywood Stories, Short Entertaining Anecdotes About the Stars and Legends of the Movies. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is 0033, and then click on the link to Stephen's website, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order the book directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Coming up next, Steve Walsh, our man in the heart of America, checking the pulse of the nation.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
If you're into the paranormal, then you're into Don Ecker and Dark Matters.
Something I have been immersed in for 20 years. Lunar research on items known as lunar transient phenomena. For over 400 years, world-class astronomers have been observing strange sights, lights, flashes, and other things on the moon.
Provocative topics, listeners' calls, and interesting guests.
My guest, Mr. Alan Stern.
On my website, I have a list of 100 or so lunar conspiracy theories. I had to kind of come to terms with one of them that I hadn't really thought about.
It's the kind of show that might keep you up at night.
Speculation is, at some time in our past, or perhaps even today, there is another presence on the moon. And I'm not talking about indigenous lunar folks. I'm talking about a space base by somebody else on the far side of the moon.
Dark Matters with Don Ecker, exclusively on CyberStationUSA.com.
Latitude, 47 degrees, 14 minutes north. Longitude, 84 degrees, 39 minutes west. Location, Montreal, Canada. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Now, Peter Anthony Holder once again brings you Steve Walsh, our man in the heart of America, checking the pulse of the nation. Lock up your daughters, and in West Virginia, your sheep. Joining Peter Anthony Holder is our intrepid embedded reporter, deep in the heartland of the U.S. of A., Stephen S. Walsh.
How you doing, Steve Arino?
Peter, I am beside myself with happiness and joy.
Boy, you...
I don't really know what that means, but it sounds pretty good anyway.
Speaking of sounds pretty good, we're talking to you via the wonderful world of Skype-to-Skype communications, and we hear you clear as a bell.
Yes, and I am sitting in my living room right now talking to you, speaking into my computer as we carry on this conversation. And the sound is unbelievable.
Isn't technology grand?
This phone, Peter, we're not using telephone. We are using computer to computer. Unbelievable.
Isn't communication grand?
Communication is wonderful and grand, and may this be the great moment we look forward to as we as we press ahead in our evolution as humanity.
Absolutely. Well, sir.
That means.
What do you have for us?
Okay, let's see. Where do we begin? I got it. Dateline, Ames, Iowa.
And by the way, when you clear your throat now, we really hear you clear your throat. That'd be the Hawkeye State.
The Hawkeye State, Missouri's northern neighbor. You know, Peter, second-degree burglary charges have been filed against an Ames man who broke into a church where he allegedly used the institution's electronic equipment to watch pornography.
Ooh.
Now, police allege this 55-year-old guy broke into the First Christian Church. After gathering items from around the building, he's believed to have gone to the basement to spend the night. Police summoned to the church by staff found the man trying to haul away a garbage can filled with food, kitchen utensils, clothing, electronic equipment, and a 26-inch flat-screen TV. That was the big prize, I guess. Anyway, Police Commander Mike Brennan said the man used the electronic equipment to watch pornographic movies that were found on him when he was arrested. How about that, huh?
Yeah, he might be living some of those movies in jail soon.
Could be. Yeah, I know. And you know, all those prison movies seem to end up the same way.
Yes.
Anyway, maybe they don't end the same way, but it's certainly one of the mileage markers along the way. Dateline, Joliet, Illinois.
That'd be the land of Lincoln.
Sure is. Yeah, Abraham is, you know, questions, interesting questions have been coming up about Abe Lincoln lately, whether he... you know, some of the things about slavery and whatnot. Did he really want to do away with slavery? But that's another story for another time, I guess, right?
Right.
Let's do something funny here. You know, Peter, if you're wearing a ski mask and carrying a gun and you walk into a store to rob that store, but there are no employees there to rob, and you call off the mission, is that an attempted robbery? Well, San Juan Reyes, who's 22 years old, and two teenagers were arrested in Joliet back in January and charged with attempting to rob the Supermercado Viva Mexico which means the Viva Mexico supermarket. Two of them acted as lookouts while the youngest, wearing a ski mask and carrying an air pistol, entered the store. Apparently, the only employees on duty were in the back room. The boy waited for a minute or so, then he bailed, and the three fled empty-handed. Now, the city's deputy chief says a crime was committed. There's no question about it. But, it's like if a tree falls in the forest and nobody hears it. Did it really fall?
Doesn't make a sound.
It an attempted robbery? Yeah. Nobody was there.
Yeah.
I think it is because they went in there with the intention. It's criminal intent, Peter. That's what it's about. Watch my finger. It's criminal intent.
Absolutely.
Dateline, Zion, Illinois.
Still the land of Lincoln.
Yeah, still more Lincoln questions. But anyway, we give props to an unnamed cab driver from Zion, Illinois. That's the most amazing cabbie in the world, I got to tell you. Our friend had been robbed at gunpoint, and when police got to the scene, they found the cab driver lying on top of the suspect, pinning him down until officers could arrest him. After taking the suspect into custody, the officers could see that the cab driver was injured. That's when they discovered that he'd been shot not once, twice, three times, four times, five times. Watch my fingers. Five times. Bullets hit the left side of his neck, the right side of his neck, near the center or back portion of his neck, in the lower lip, his jaw, and his back. And it was after being shot that the cab driver jumped into the back seat of the cab, where he struggled with the suspect, eventually able to subdue this guy, hold him down. Our hero was rushed to the hospital, where he underwent surgery and was listed in critical condition. But he survived, and he is a hero.
Wow. Don't shoot Mongo. That'll just make him angry.
Mongo straight. Dateline, Columbus, Ohio.
Oh no, Ohio. I can hardly wait to say goodbye.
There's that music. It's the Buckeye State.
I can hear it now. I used to live there, you know.
I remember.
Yeah. In Columbus, where I lived, of course, a 68-year-old grandfather named Ralph Canoni was arrested for allegedly punching random children in a local Walmart store. Police came to the store after a six-year-old boy complained to his mother that the guy had punched him in the back of the head. The woman followed Canoni out of the store, grabbed his arm, led him back inside, and notified security. A review of the store's surveillance camera not only confirmed the punching of the six-year-old boy, but also revealed blows to his seven-year-old brother and two other boys. Canoni later told police that he would put his keys between his fingers and strike the children when their parents weren't looking. What a nasty guy.
Ouch.
He said he'd been doing it since January because he liked the excitement of getting away with it. His public defender said in court that Mr. Canoni has mental health issues. Ya think?
Yeah, he's going to get some scratching when he's in jail, too.
Yeah, I think so. There might even be video. You never know. Dateline, Little Rock, Arkansas.
That'll be Land of Bill or the Natural State.
Yeah, whichever you prefer. You know, retired Army Colonel Conrad Reynolds is running for a U.S. Senate seat from Arkansas, but is rather miffed that a state law prevents him from using his military title as a nickname on the ballot this spring. Apparently in Arkansas, that's a privilege reserved only for nicknames such as Porky, Bubba, and Two. Two, that's right. Reynolds planned to file candidacy papers under the name Conrad Colonel Reynolds, but election officials wouldn't allow it. Under state law, only already elected officials can use their titles on the ballot. But Reynolds said the law is unfair to him and to voters who believe military ranks should be included as part of the candidate's title or nickname. He added, people say, hey, Colonel, all the time. It's one of those rare instances where it's both a title and a nickname. In the meantime, the state had no problem putting Harold Porky Kimbrell on the ballot, a nickname Kimbrell said he's had since the fifth grade. Kinky Friedman was allowed on the ballot as Richard Kinky Friedman, as was Representative David Bubba Powers. And DeJames Rogers II said he put his nickname Two on the ballot because he was worried that few people would know him otherwise. Because there are apparently in that part of Arkansas, there are a lot of DeJameses. So he calls himself Two because his father was DeJames as well.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
Make me angry, I tell you. You know, Peter, I got to tell you, I'm angry right now. Even though I'm very happy we have the Skype set up, it's working very well. I'm a little angry over something, and I hope you'll allow me to share it with you.
Yes, please.
It's about April, Peter, and you know, people get angry. They throw things. Not me. I take keyboard in hand and write a two-minute tirade, and I've done that now. And it is time for that two-minute tirade. I want to go off on something that really angers me, something most of the listeners experienced in the last week or so. I'm talking about April Fool's Day. It's stupid and a waste of time. That's what it is. It's a waste of a day in which little of substance gets done, because most people with gray matter, that's people like you and me, assume that someone is trying to be funny, so they disregard anything that's said. Allow me to explain. In the news and information business, I and others are constantly scouring the other sites, you know, the newspapers, the radios, the TVs, the blogs, and so on, to learn of important political and other goings-on in our world. Usually, when a tweet from one of these reliable sources comes our way, we look further into it and go as far as to say, gee, we better write something ourselves, or at least retweet. You don't do that on April Fool's Day. No, on April Fool's Day, only the gullible are silly enough to fall for some of these outlandish claims. That leaves those of us who are capable of thought to automatically disregard the truly ridiculous claims. But they leave us wondering about the odd claims that just might be true. For example, a tweet that a politician filed to run for office in the wrong state, well, that's automatically dismissed as a joke. But one that has a politician withdrawing from the race because of income tax problems, hey, that could be real. It has happened many times in the past. So, many of us simply dismiss just about anything we see as being an ill attempt at humor, and we wait until the next day to resume our lives. Folks, there was a time when April Fool's Day caught certain people who couldn't help but be pranked. That has changed to the point that just about everyone is aware it's April Fool's Day and is expecting some stupid prank, so no one falls for any of this stuff anymore. It's a stupid tradition, one that's best left on the dung heap of history.
The dung heap of history.
I like saying that. Dung is not something we get to say every day.
Not every day. No. No.
I'm saying it now, though, because that's the kind of guy I am.
And, sir, on that note.
Yes. What would you like me to say?
Say those three magic words. Yes.
Hit the theme!
This is the Stuff File.
And we're almost done with this edition of The Stuff File. Just a couple more Stuff File stories and, of course, an idiot coming your way. First, we start off with Boise, Idaho. In Boise, 18-year-old Tiffany M. Wallace was arrested after she allegedly rammed her pickup into another car. But that's not the worst of it. Oh, no. She also, dare I even say it, hurled ranch salad dressing at the other vehicle. The driver of the other car told police the encounter began when he was cut off by Wallace. He said she later cut him off again, yelling at him and throwing coins and plastic containers of ranch dressing at his car. The victim said Wallace later rammed his car at least three times in a parking lot. Well, I hope it was at least cool ranch dressing. The horror. Meanwhile, 33-year-old Umberto Murillo of California was staying at the Hyatt Regency Waikiki Resort and Spa in Hawaii when he allegedly stole two 12-packs of beer from the hotel at the ABC store and walked out without paying. He was then confronted by a store manager and another tourist. During the confrontation, Umberto apparently passed out and then died. His wife has now apologized to the entire hotel staff for her husband's outlandish behavior. Who are we kidding? No, she's suing the hotel, saying it's somehow their fault he died. Officials at the Hyatt Regency and ABC stores would not comment on the lawsuit. Meanwhile, Alexa Gonzalez, age 12, was doodling on her desk with an erasable marker at Junior High School 190 in Queens, New York. I did say erasable marker, did I not? Yes. School officials called in police, yes, who arrested her and took her to the precinct house in handcuffs, detaining her for several hours. I made two little doodles, she said later. It could have easily been erased. I did say erasable marker, did I not? Yes. Yes, I did. I started crying. I was crying a lot. Once reporters got wind of this story, school officials backpedaled. Based on what we've seen so far, this shouldn't have happened, said City Education Department spokesperson David Cantor. Even when we're asked to make an arrest, common sense should prevail. This according to police spokesperson Paul Brown. Still, the girl was suspended from school for several days and she was sentenced to 8 hours of community service. Yeah, right. Give the marker to school officials, I say, and make them right. The punishment should fit the crime 5 million times or until they actually understand the concept, whichever comes first. Believe it or not, that story didn't make it as idiot of the day. This one does.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
In Brisbane, Australia, 27-year-old Timothy Daniel Hodges was arrested after he allegedly bought a pair of scissors at one 7-Eleven convenience store, then used them to rob another 7-Eleven convenience store less than 300 yards away. Even weirder, he planned to use an unknowing cab driver as his getaway driver, but when the cabbie figured out what was going on, he refused to drive off and call police. That's when Tim broke the cab driver's nose. Police say Tim spent several minutes looking in garbage bins for a weapon, but when he couldn't find one, he went to the 7-Eleven across the street to buy the scissors. He ultimately pleaded guilty to armed robbery with personal violence and assault and has just been sentenced to 3 years in the pokey. Why would someone go from one store to buy a weapon to rob another store across the street? There's only one explanation and one explanation only, and that is, he's an idiot.
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, number 0033. Hope you've enjoyed it. The website for this program is thestufffile.com, and stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, that's thestufffile.com. You can go there and you'll find all the information and links on our guests on the What's On page. Just look for the corresponding number for the program of this show, and again, that's 0033. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook at facebook.com/PAHolder, and Twitter at twitter.com/PAHolder. We hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including cyberstationusa.com and World FM 88.5 FM in New Zealand. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Before we go, we'd like to leave you with a helpful instructional message from the National Association of People Who Have Trouble Walking and Chewing Gum at the Same Time. Step, chew, step, chew, step, chew, step, step. Oh, God. I always screw it up.